This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry today. Well, given the talk of a possible ceasefire between Israel and Hamas yesterday, it's probably safe to say we're not today quite where we had hoped to be. Instead, today, Tel Aviv sounds like this.
A bus had an explosion inside due to a bomb. About 10 casualties were treated and evacuated by Magen David Adom ambulance teams to the nearby hospital in Tel Aviv. Three of the casualties are severely to moderately injured.
In Gaza, sounds like this. For the first time in this latest conflict, the violence was felt directly in the center of Tel Aviv after a bomb went off on a bus, injuring at least 10 people. You heard it there. Well, international efforts to finalize a truce are being stepped up. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton and UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon are visiting leaders in the region. Mrs. Clinton is in Cairo. She says Washington is looking for, quote, a durable outcome after a week of bloodshed. Israel's Deputy Foreign Minister, Danny Ayalon, joins us from our partner, the BBC, in Washington, D.C., to share his perspective. He's also former Israeli ambassador to the United States. Ambassador, thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Todd.
We heard the secretary use the phrase durable outcome. Can you explain what that means from Israel's perspective beyond simply a stop in rocket fire coming from Gaza? What does durable mean?
Yes, and this is the crux of the matter and why this agreement was so elusive, since Hamas does not want to talk about a durable settlement. That means they would like to keep the option to fire at will and terrorize more than 4 million, half of our population. So we will have to bite our lips and tongues and continue to endure with the hope that Hamas will stop in time. Otherwise, we'll have to consider more operations all the way even to land maneuvers and ground operations. Although we are here very reluctant warriors, we would not like to reach that point.
Danny Ayalon, as we take a little bit of a step back from the current crisis, a small step back, one can easily understand a response taking out rocket sites where rockets have been launched from. That makes sense to probably almost anyone who would be watching this conflict. In the end, if a truce, a ceasefire, durable outcome, whatever we want to call it, is reached in the next hours or couple of days here, what will Israel have achieved in this operation beyond the destruction of actual rocket sites and the militants firing them? Strategically or conceptually, what will Israel have gained after 8 or 9 days of this?
Hopefully, deterrence. And if the Hamas will think twice and more than twice for the next time when they want to fire at kindergartens or malls or places or parks, this will have been worthwhile. Although, unfortunately, too late for the 6 Israelis killed and for the hundreds of thousands of children who have been traumatized.
And for the hundreds of Palestinians killed as well. Not all of the
Absolutely.
People who've been killed by Israeli rockets are militants.
Absolutely, Todd. And here I can tell you that, we have been very, very careful. And I think that although every innocent death is tragic, and it's hard to make comparison, but I think we have been much more accurate and than other operations. We are studying from past operations and mistakes. And if you compare the situation in Gaza, let's say, to the situation in Syria today, where the Assad regime just mercilessly butchers people and children, there is a big difference. And I would say that most of the people that were hit in Gaza deserved it, as they were just armed terrorists.
Danny Ayalon, one of the forces marginalized in this current conflict, of course, is the Palestinian Authority in Ramallah, who you have been able to talk to in the past. Is there not an opportunity here, maybe in the next weeks or months, not today, to get back to the table with the Palestinian Authority on a broader solution that has the side benefit, perhaps, of marginalizing Hamas, which it seems might be a common interest of both the Palestinian Authority and Israel?
Absolutely, and we are still waiting at the table. It was unfortunate that almost 4 years went by, actually wasted because of the Palestinian Authority under the leadership of Abu Mazen refused the direct negotiations. They put a lot of hurdles and preconditions whereby had they been talking to us with mutual respect, I think many of the problems could have been passed. But this stubbornness about preconditions and on the one hand and on the other hand not really recognizing our right for self-determination, whether it's a Jewish state or our needs for security arrangements, all these things should be on the table and could be discussed. I hope that this will be an opportunity for Abu Mazen to rethink and not go for a unilateral moves at the UN or anywhere else against all the understandings and past agreements with them and come to the table. This is high time to do that.
Before we let you go, Danny Aiello, can you give us any sense of a timeline for a ceasefire, a truce, de-escalation within the next few hours or days here? What can we expect? Is an announcement imminent?
I hope the secretary is still in Cairo, and of course the activities and the involvement of the Egyptian government is invaluable. And I hope that hours and not days we will have good news.
Danny Aiello is Israel's deputy foreign minister, also former Israeli ambassador to the United States. Ambassador, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
So after more than a week, conditions in Gaza are getting tougher. We know that plenty of people now are without power. Schools are being used as shelters. Life has some way to go before returning to anything close to normal as Israeli rockets continue to rain down, targeting Hamas in Gaza. To get an idea about the current conditions there, here's a dispatch from the BBC's Gaza correspondent, John Donison.
Well, it's just coming up to around about midnight now, and I'm just about to go to bed. It's been a pretty difficult day for Gazans, the worst really of this latest escalation, more than 20 people killed, many of them children, and Gazans are probably wondering whether they're in for another difficult night. There's a sound of Israeli drone planes overhead, and I've just learnt that in Arabic the drones are called Zanana, which means whining child, and it is a pretty irritating sound, I'm sure, for most Gazans. The other sound you can hear, of course, is the sound of the sea. Well, I've been in bed less than half an hour or so now, and already the sound of heavy shelling from Israeli warships off the coast of Gaza. Well, it's dawn now in Gaza, just after 6 o'clock local time, and that was two massive blasts sounding like Israeli airstrikes pretty close to where we are now. Well, we're just driving now through the centre of Gaza City pretty fast. Normally at this time of the morning, it would be chock-a-block with traffic, but just looking around now, there's virtually no one on the streets. A lot of the shops are boarded up, and I can see up ahead on the road a lot of debris on the road from an airstrike. It's blocked off. We're going to have to take another route.
That was the BBC's Gaza correspondent, John Donison. Well, Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has now arrived in Cairo. This comes after stops in Jerusalem and the West Bank yesterday, all part of the push for a ceasefire or at least a period of calm. Peter Baker is the White House correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. He's been traveling with the president this week as he visited countries in the Far East. Hi, Peter.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton has used the diplomatic phrase durable outcome after being dispatched from the Far East trip that you were on to the Middle East by the president. Help us decode durable outcome in diplomatic speak to English. What does that mean to the White House, to the U.S. administration?
Well, they were trying to make sure that this isn't a one-off situation. They need the rockets that have been fired by Hamas into Israel to stop. That's the precondition they set for everything. And they don't want to be back in the Middle East in a few days doing the same thing over again. So it's funny, they don't use the phrase ceasefire, which is sort of a phrase that's been traditionally used, obviously, in Middle East shuttle diplomacy. They're using the phrase de-escalation. It's a kind of vague phrase at the moment, but as you say, they don't want it to be a de-escalation that lasts only a day or so.
When Hillary Clinton was dispatched to the region, there were plenty of people on the ground and plenty of us here at a distance who thought it must mean that good news is at hand. After all, you don't usually send your top diplomats or the president into a situation where failure is the order of the day. You want them to be associated with success. It hasn't come yet. Is that interpretation accurate in this case, that you would send Hillary Clinton in if success were at hand?
I mean, certainly, I think you send her in if you think success is possible. I think that they are cognizant that this isn't easy and that this is, in fact, not simply a matter of her going there and wrapping a bow around something that was already ready to take place. President Obama is placing a lot of his hopes and investment in President Morsi of Egypt. He talked to him three times within 24 hours while in Cambodia and on Air Force One heading home. So he's counting very strongly on the Egyptians to be able to pull back Hamas, to be able to influence Hamas in a way that no other actor in the region seems to be able to do.
Is there confidence building or proof of confidence building going on between Egypt and the United States in this sense? Because after the Arab Spring, after our guy Mubarak was out and Morsi came in, associated strongly with the Muslim Brotherhood, there's a trust problem or maybe a confidence problem between the U.S. and that new government. Is this largely confidence building that the U.S. can know we can trust Egypt to lead in the region?
I do think this is a decisive moment in that regard. This is a moment of truth, in effect, where we are evaluating this new government and trying to see, is Egypt going to be a constructive partner in this way? But I think the president is convinced that Morsi is, in fact, a genuine actor on the stage, that he's giving him a straight scoop when they talk, that he genuinely wants to keep the peace treaty that Egypt has had with Israel now since the 1970s, and that he can be an important conduit as a product of the Muslim Brotherhood, an important conduit between the United States and more radical elements in the Middle East that the United States doesn't talk to directly.
And Peter Baker, just before we let you go quickly here, is there any indication that the United States is pushing for something beyond the immediate durable outcome, that they would want to push Israel back to the table with the Palestinian Authority, hopefully to marginalize Hamas here?
Well, I think that they feel like they have to get this settled first. I mean, any possibility of a deeper, longer, more involved peace process is just, has now been delayed and put off until they can get this resolved. I mean, there's been talk about why the president hadn't gone to Israel in his first term, and I think there have been discussions in the White House about when they would make that happen in the second term. Well, that's now on the shelf. That's now, no longer possible because they have to only go, as you say, when the president's able to announce something that's worthwhile.
Right. Peter Baker, White House correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. As violence continues in Gaza, a bus exploding earlier today in Tel Aviv. Peter, thank you.
Thank you.
Come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.